One quick message before I start the show. You can find all the links and resources for this episode by visiting the show notes on rickyrichards.com. If you enjoy this episode, do consider subscribing on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you're feeling particularly generous, you can help me to grow the show by leaving a review on iTunes. For anyone who does subscribe, review or share, thank you. I appreciate it. Now let's get into the show. Welcome to Ricky Richards Represents, the show where I talk tips for success with leading figures of creativity and innovation. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the show. My guest today is Tom Oldham, a London-based portrait photographer who shot portraits of musicians, sports stars and everyone in between. His work has appeared in the National Portrait Gallery, and to name drop just a few of his subjects, he's photographed the likes of the Foo Fighters, Richard Branson, Usain Bolt, Alicia Keys, Mario Balotelli, Bradley Wiggins, Tiny Temper, Arctic Monkeys, Dizzy Rascal, Professor Green, Gilbert and George, Jose Mourinho, Ed Sheeran, Elizabeth Troy, Henrik Larsson, Liam Howlett, Cesc Fabregas, Thierry Henry and King Krul, among many, many others, as well as occasionally doing self-initiated projects which have taken him to the mountains of Africa and beyond. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
You can see how I would struggle with the intros occasionally, tongue twisters.
No, you nailed it.
So could you, to start off, there's actually not much online really about how you started out in the industry. Could you take us back to where you started and how you actually progressed into being a photographer?
Yeah, it was fairly non-traditional route, I suppose. I didn't come from photography or anything like that. We didn't have cameras in our house, and I grew up in very rural Dorset on a farm, and we weren't exactly moneyed, so photography wasn't was quite an expensive sort of hobby, I guess, maybe back then. And I got to my 21st birthday and I just quite fancied a watch for my birthday. And the girlfriend I had at the time said, why don't you get a camera? I think she liked the idea of going out with a photographer. And I thought, you know, that sounds interesting, you know, that's a good idea. And started, and I got one, and it was a Canon EOS 1000, like a very entry level film camera. Just started sort of shooting what was around me, you know, my friends and family, and just learning the craft really, and did an even class in Bournemouth, and then it just sort of, I have very slow cogs in my mind, and they turn very, very painfully slowly, but it did occur to me that I had a very boring job at the time, that this photography thing could be a ticket out of here, and did a night class in Shelley Park in Bournemouth, and then I'm really umming and ahhing a lot. A lot of editing for your poor guy.
how old were you back when you actually decided to make that transition?
This was straight after being 21, 21st birthday, and just getting straight into it and thinking, yeah, there's something in this. And yeah, like I said, did a night class and then enrolled in Plymouth College of Art and Design to do a 2-year national diploma. Just a very basic sort of photo course, you know, but there was just enough to really turn me on into it. And I was working in Next before that. Used to actually be quite a cool sort of shop back in the day. I know, as hard as that is to believe.
I was co-op. So
were you?
I was, yeah.
Okay, well, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And I went to Plymouth, did a 2-year thing there, really, really enjoyed it, and but by no means was ready after that course to become a photographer. So thank absolute God, the college had an opening in the stores, the equipment stores. And I just spent then a couple of years selling film, handing out equipment to students and learning the craft.
In those early days, normally when, you know, your teachers are showing you stuff, you tend to latch on to one or a few bits of inspiration. Were there people back then that you were like, you know, you were really inspired by their bits of work and part of you wanted to emulate it, I guess?
I was really, really hungry for knowledge about it then. I was really, really sort of desperate for inspiration and looked absolutely everywhere. So Ansel Adams actually was the landscape photographer, which it was his level of technical expertise that he could achieve that I'd read about. And, you know, Don McCullen, people like that, that just really, really earned it. Really, really just earned their place in history, you know, and that was incredibly inspirational. That not that he influenced me as such, I don't suppose, but probably more modern influence I got at the time was from the explosion of dance music and culture and rave and the magazines that grew up around that, you know. So that was really, really a blossoming sort of area at the time. And soon after, sort of, I was photographing raves and just really just on the rinse, trying to get in for nothing. started being the guy in the clubs with the camera and just trying to get the nitty gritty of not just sort of DJ shots, really, just crowds, and just aware that life wouldn't always look like this, you know. So trying to document as much of that as I could. Document's a bit of a flouncy word for it, really, but just trying to sort of capture what I was doing.
Can you recall your first ever intentional portrait photograph?
Well, yes, it wasn't that relevant at first because portraiture as such, because I came quite a sort of slow route into portraiture because I didn't actually go freelance until I was 29. So I was doing so much sort of club stuff and photographed for like Ministry magazine. And actually, I mean, an interesting sort of point for me was there was this super cool magazine called Sleaze Nation that pretty much nobody will remember, right? But it was hugely influential at the time, and along the same lines as sort of The Face and ID, that kind of school. And I started contributing images to them, right? And just sending in, I can't actually remember how I initiated contact with them, but I think I was, they just said, send us your film and we'll process it. And if there's anything good that we like, we'll put it in the mag, right? So the only way of finding out whether I had got published that month was to go down to WH Smith's in Plymouth, find the magazine on the day it came out, open it and see if they'd use my shots, right? Wow. For this beautiful clubbing section they had in black and white film called Savoir Vivre. And they started, the first shot I had published in this, honestly, so cool magazine was just a line of urinals, right? in a grimy club. And I was like, oh my God, this is so brilliant. I've got to do it. I've got to do more of this. And the day that really changed for me was going down there, and I never ever knew, right? And I'd get 25 quid a page, right? If any shots went, man, which I later found out his actual page rate was 75 quid, and he was skanking me, the guy.
Right.
But it didn't. The money, yeah, was nothing. By no means was it about money.
You were in a cool mag.
I was in a cool mag.
Invaluable.
Yeah, exactly. That's what they thought, definitely. I went down there, and I'd been in Brighton like a few weeks before photographing a club thing, and the magazine came out, it was on the shelves, I've eagerly sort of flicked through it like I always did, and on the opening shot was two naked guys that I'd photographed who'd run out of this club and ran straight into the sea, stripped off, ran straight into the sea, and I got them sort of sunny side to camera with their arms in the air, just like just a brilliant opportunity with flash, and just lit them up in this sea of sort of black sea water, and there it was on the page, right? And the rush that I can still remember it so clearly now, how exciting it was to be published in exactly the magazine I wanted to be, full page, with a really glorious and quite edgy sort of shot. And I was like, this is what I want to do, this is what I've got to do. And really, really happily, it was sort of the only thing I could do, actually. So once you've got that lure, then there's nothing else that you can aim for, you know. And that was all while I was working at the art college. So I was just sort of building up contacts and expertise and experience until I felt ready to leave college, age 29, and go freelance.
So in that period where you went freelance, can you recall what your first ever commercial shot was and exactly how you navigated that? I mean, how did you feel experienced at that time or not really?
So me and this other guy set up a magazine called, we thought we were very experienced, yes, but we were not. And me and this other guy set up this mag, and it similarly was in WH Smith's, and I was the sort of photographer in chief for it. And we had to go and photograph the Cardigans, the band, the Cardigans, right? And I really excitedly drove up from Plymouth for this hour-long shoot we had in a hotel, and I had some equipment with me, and we got into the hotel, loaded it in and got into the room, and there was 10 minutes at the end of this hour for photos, right? And I don't know if you remember the Cardigans, but they had a really beautiful singer, they're from Sweden, I think they're from, and we needed a really lovely shot of the singer. So I went to plug in my lighting kit that I brought with me, these tungsten sort of 800 watt lights, and they're different plugs in the hotel room, and I couldn't plug them in. And I was absolutely scuppered, right? And Ilford had just brought out this 3,200 ISO film in medium format, and I had a beautiful Hasselblad with me to again, film camera, obviously, to shoot them with. And your listeners won't realise I'm making the wind-on gesture of a Hasselblad and looking down into the prism there. not great radio. I was absolutely scuppered, and they just brought out this really fast film that will respond to very low light levels, and by pure fortune there was just enough light coming through this window. But this was for the cover of the first issue of the magazine. We had 1 hour with them, a 10-minute photo shoot. I had to photograph the rest of the band as well for feature shots, and we had, which meant I had about 3 minutes to photograph the cover. This would be a bit of a recurring theme in my life, just having not enough time to get something. And I foolishly decided to sort of waste one of those 3 minutes saying, you know, it's nearly Christmas, are you going home, what are you doing? Trying to make them feel comfortable that I'd read probably somewhere that's what you're supposed to do. And the singer said to me, look, can we just get on with this? And I was like, yeah, we can. Yeah, okay. And got the shots, you know, and it looked great, but it was a pretty cold experience. And it really, really opened my eyes to how the talent is not your friend. You're supposed to be as professional as they are. Get the job done. And maybe if you're friends afterwards, then terrific. But
so you know. On that subject, I mean, I had a question which related to this, to the time sensitivity, because I noticed on your blog, there was a shot of Usain Bolt, and you said, you know, we had 10 minutes with him. It's actually one of my favourite shots of his face, like quite large. Having gone through those experiences over and over again, how do you set yourself up differently now to react to a situation where you've got a couple of minutes?
Yeah, you just prioritise now the best idea first, and you can't in any way prepare for, you know, Richard Branson is a great example of that, he will come in and you'll be set up for one shot, and he can very commonly say, okay, let's do this one over here. And you've got to tell Sir Richard Branson, multi-billionaire, no, sorry, we're doing this, you know, which can really change the tone in the room, you know. And so being prepared, being flexible, being quick, being over-equipped, over-manned, as well. But there's a really lovely portrait, I think, of him on my website, because whenever I've photographed him before, he's always got like his thumbs up, or he's holding something or someone or something, he's promoing something, you know. And it's just a clean sort of side-on shot of his magnificence, you know. And I had three frames before he said, right, thanks very much, and shakes my hand and walks off, you know. So if I'd been trying to warm him up, or not been ready, or had my exposure hadn't been right, or something along those lines, then I definitely would not have got that.
I can imagine that being the cover of his Walter Isaacson autobiography one day. It's that kind of shot. You can really picture it.
I hope so.
In those situations, again, you're dealing with extremely big characters, people that can kind of come in and dominate a room. And as you've rightly just said there, you're there to direct them and say, no, this is the shot we need to get. Do you, in those moments, do you turn it on in order to be like, you know, I need to be as authoritative as they are in a way, in order to kind of steer it your way? Or can you find yourself being overruled at times?
Do a bit of research. Generally, they know what they're there to do, and they know what hopefully is involved with it. Shall I veer into my really long David Grohl story about this?
Go for it.
It might be an opportune moment. I tell you,
let's do the Dave Grohl version that gets to the point, as you said.
It does. So Dave Grohl is the nicest man in rock, right? Everyone knows that. So I had to photograph him twice over 2 days, and the first time, I can't believe I'm saying this. this could be viewed as unprofessional, but I think it just sums it up. So in terms of big characters, and I had 3 minutes and 16 seconds with him on the first day, because he was hungover, he was tired, he was jet lagged. He walks into the room, sits on this sofa that we had to shoot him on, and he's not into it. And I'm spitting out anything I've got to try and get this reaction that we needed for the cover of this magazine, The Fly. And he just sort of gets up after a while and just sort of goes, right, thanks, you know, cheers. And I was like, wow, is that the nicest man in rock? Because if so, we've had it, you know. It wasn't a great experience. And the next day I had to photograph them again for the same magazine, but a different sort of part of the feature. And he was, am I allowed to drop F-bombs on your podcast?
Okay. Oh, yeah, of course. Go for it.
Okay, thanks. The next day I'm photographing him. We're all set up and it's in a different location. And he goes, oh, man, this fucking photographer guy we had yesterday, he said, ooh, the camera loves you, Dave. I was like, what the fuck? And I said, Dave, that was me. I photographed you yesterday. And it was really like, oh, man.
I hope you got a shot of his face going cherry red.
Yeah. Do you know what? To his credit, he was really ashamed that he had sort of rubbished me in front of everyone, right? I'm blushing now thinking about it. But he consequently became the nicest, sweetest, most obliging subject for the whole rest of the shoot. Was super cool. And then on the Saturday, he was performing at V Festival. And I was down in the pit with all the other photographers, about 30 of us, waiting to go in. And waiting to shoot Foo Fighters. And Dave Grohl climbs down off the stage, walks across the thing, walks through the pit up to me and goes, hey, man, what the fuck are you doing here? And I was like, come to photograph you, Dave.
Yeah, as if.
And he only did that to make me look good in front of all of my photographic peers, you know. And sometimes, my point being, sometimes a really big character like that can swing either way. And, it, you know, you have to be able to manage that, whatever
that
happens.
It seems like he's quite aware of the fact that, you know, a story like that could emanate at the same time and that he...
I don't think he cares about that.
No.
No, he's too big.
Yeah,
too big.
That's true. That is true.
Yeah.
You know, on the subject of your photographic peers, everyone who has a phone in their pocket right now thinks that they can be a photographer, myself included, everyone in the entire world, everyone on Instagram. Yeah. What is your opinion on this mass democratization of camera equipment and the accessibility of it? And also for young, talented photographers, people that actually stand a shot, like what would your advice be to differentiate yourself?
So for one, it's important for me to say I'm a massive fan of that. That photography is now in the hands of everyone, and it's not a class issue or that doesn't relate to income or anything like that. Now everyone can access a camera. For one, most people who are interested in photography can access a good quality RAW file now, which, you know, was in the hands of the elite previously, which I am not a fan of at all. And that can only be good, that the means of documentation are in the hands of not just middle-class, white, privileged, middle-aged males, right? So that's great. Any day of the week, that's amazing. So it's really important to acknowledge the shift, I think, that's occurred in photography and that great democratization I really, really believe in. So I've forgotten what your point was. Well, my point was, not your one.
For young people kind of starting out today, how do they differentiate themselves in this market, which is extremely crowded?
Quality, I think. So I've told this story a few times, but in 1 week, I photographed portraits of Arctic Monkeys in the studio and Usain Bolt. On the running track for Puma, and one had a budget, one had no budget, but I shot them both on the same DSLR that everybody was using at the time, and you know, I was like, I'm getting these incredible opportunities, and yet I'm shooting them on the exactly same camera that everybody is. You know, how am I supposed to make my work look any different? You know, and it was at that point I sort of took the leap to get medium format digital, and I went with Hasselblad and bought it on layaway, you know, over 2 years. And it was £1,000 a month for 2 years. So it's a significant sort of sum, but it enabled me to differentiate my work through quality. And I think that stood me in really good stead. I definitely noticed that my clients were saying to me, how come your pictures look so good? You know, and they do look and feel different. There's amazing glass and just really big chips. And
so just to dig into that, how much is a Hasselblad camera?
You can get a beautiful camera for 11 grand plus VAT. now, plus lenses. But I spread it over.
So very democratized technology.
Is it? I don't know.
No,
I
mean, it's definitely not.
It's not, is it? But that's not to say that digital photography, I mean, you don't have to go Hasselblad. You know, this is purely in reference to the offers of work I was getting at the time and what... Yeah, for me, it just those were the demands that I felt I should be making operating at the level I'm at.
What you did there is you invested in your future and took quite a sizable risk to take that kind of responsibility on financially.
Yeah,
to pay off over 2 years to pursue what you wanted to do,
Or just how I wanted my pictures to look.
Yeah, and that in itself is a way that you've differentiated yourself in that moment.
Yeah, but that's not to say that... something else that relates to the thing that's happened is that young people aren't afraid of software. So they're really able to dig right in with the capabilities, I think, of Photoshop and animation and all of those things that I'm terrified of. I'm terrible with software. And because I just want to think about cameras and lenses and lights and positioning and not... all the other stuff photographers have to think about, you know, that there's this whole huge back-end operation now as well that I actually believe is better left to professionals, that's all they do all day, you know.
One ambition that many photographers and just people in general have is that they can travel with their work, something you've been fortunate enough to do.
Mm.
Was it ever a conscious decision to try and get more projects that were outside of your vicinity? And if so... how did you go about doing that, or what opportunities came your way, I guess?
Do you know, there's nothing worse than, for me, hearing people moan about being at airports, right? Because I really love being at airports. And the privilege of being in the air with a camera bag above you in the locker thing and just going somewhere to do something is, I will never, you know, like, please put this in a memory bank somewhere. And if I ever moan about it, like, kick my ass, because I, like, being flown to... I never dreamt that I would be flown to Africa because I own a bag of cameras, you know. And, yeah, I've had some astonishing experiences in brilliant places that some of which have been self-initiated and others with clients and, you know, just dream scenarios. Like, really, really, really brilliant. So I've been to Africa a real lot, and those are the memories that stick in my mind the most. You know,
How did you actually go about being approached for those projects? Was it something that you self-initiated, or...?
Yeah, very, very much so. I had some friends that worked in the charity sector, and I just said to them, you know, who do you know that you trust and is doing good work and might be... maybe could use an upping of their sort of media, their media package, I suppose, really, that, you know, that a photographer could sort of chip in and make an impact, you know. So I was introduced to this really small NGO, really small here, but quite big in Africa, called Riders for Health, where they just have a very simple, under the radar, like understated operation supplying transport solutions to sort of the National Health Service of the Gambia and places like that. So they just supply sort of logistics and training and people on the ground to help get blood testing and medicine transported to places where four-wheel drives can't sort of get to. So I've done just loads of stuff for them, and just really, really brilliant.
In the second section of the interview, I wanted to ask Tom about his creative approach and how he's refined his craft over the years. As someone who works closely with famous people, I'd imagine he'd be used to making even the strongest characters comfortable. And I was keen to find out if he had any tips for how we can win people over quickly in any situation. In your opinion, what actually makes a great portrait photographer?
That's a great question. I wish I knew. For me, the skills essential to a portrait, being a good portrait photographer, is a clear vision of what you want your pictures to look like. A simple direction with your subject in order to achieve those images, but also your demeanour and your manner and your calmness and your experience with the technical. So all that's automatic which just enables you to just engage with the pictures. So get all your lighting and lens and camera and all that data that's dashing about in your eyes while you're trying to frame up a picture. Lock all of that so it doesn't mean anything. You know it's right and you're rehearsed and you're practiced and you can just engage with your subject and enable them to give you the photograph that you want.
Two things I want to dig into there from what you've just said. The first is, when you talk about pre-prep, are you sourcing images that you kind of, you like the lighting of that, or are you scamping up drawings of, you know, how you imagine the shot to be?
That is a really good workflow to sketch out your pictures first, to do that by hand, and to just set about hammering that idea all the way to final execution. You know, that's a really, really good workflow that I'd recommend for anyone new in photography, just to sketch out their ideas, go to the shoot prepared, hammer that until you know you've got it and you've seen it on a big screen, and then, you know, retouch and process and do all that stuff you got to do, and then go back to your drawing and go, did I achieve it? You know, and then share it if you feel you did, and if they're strong enough. So that, in terms of lighting and what I intend the images to look like, generally, it's a sort of development of my own style. So I don't, certainly prefer not to have to lift that off anywhere else. You know, if the subject's a well-known person, then you see what's gone before you, certainly, and see what other people have done, so you're not, you know, overlapping with anyone, certainly. But really, it's a development of my own thing, just using somebody different, you know.
We've already touched on this a couple of times. ever so slightly with regards to you actually interacting with your subjects. But what are some of your kind of go-to techniques for warming up the subject?
you really need to create a harmonious sort of studio experience so that all the team that I've got with me are all like, I don't use an aggressive technique or anything. Some people try to be jarring and try to make their models or subjects quite uncomfortable, you know, because it makes for an edgier shot. And I'm just so not that guy that I want them to feel warm. I want them to like me, I suppose, and therefore put them in a really awkward position if they then don't give me what I want because I've been so nice.
So is that, like you say, doing your background research and then going in on, like, how do you bridge that gap? And make people like, because that is such a skill to have someone warm to you in just a few minutes. I mean, as an example, today you walked in with some cake, and you know, instantly we sat down and had a little chat before we walked in the studio, and you know, I feel like I know you better already.
Yeah, that was mainly because I wanted some cake.
Right.
Well, are you getting paid loads of money for this?
No, definitely not. No.
So don't we want a sort of environment where everyone's sort of happy anyway and pleased to be here?
That's yeah, definitely.
And roll that out as a standard with everyone you meet, and you just have, it lends itself to positive experiences, doesn't it? And engagement and warmth. And what kind of world would we live in where we can't sit down and have a bit of cake before we go to work?
It's true. You've already talked about the Dave Grohl, that's correct, isn't it? Experience, but just to kind of be fully transparent into what's the biggest fuck up you've ever had on set in your career?
Well, that one I told you about with the cardigans from the off wasn't great. That was a proper kick in the ass for me. I have made every fuck up from, you know, not having the right film, enough film, not having, you know, thought about it and brought the right equipment, long enough lenses, having to borrow things from people, all the ashamed, scorching embarrassment that it enables you to remember to own all the kit you need and to bring it with you just in case. And, you know, I don't drink anymore, but I used to drink, you know.
make your shots a bit more edgy.
Or just working in music, you know, it's conducive to that sort of lifestyle, I suppose, but it isn't conducive actually to really good results always. So dragging that to trash as a concept.
you just briefly mentioned.
Did I answer your question? I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, to some degree.
I don't, the biggest fucker, I can't think of like.
Oh, was there one that you
I've had like stuff, you know, one day shoots, once brings to mind with Queens of the Stone Age, where our equipment didn't arrive, you know, and we had to run around and hire equipment in Portugal on a Saturday afternoon or something, and that was really fucking god awful.
I always
find the results reflected it.
You know, when you've had a bad one, when you know, you're struggling to sleep that night going, I'm really cocked up here. And then you know that 6 months down the line, you're going to look at this and laugh, or you're not going to worry about it. But in that moment, it feels like there's some form of turmoil. Yeah, I mean, the Dave Grohl incident, like you say, is probably exactly that. But I just thought there's such funny scenarios to look back on in hindsight and say, you know, what you can learn from these experiences.
You remember it all, don't you? Like, like I said, the scorching embarrassment of, like, head in hands, sort of, oh, my God, I really made a bad job of that.
So when these events occur and you've got to do things on the fly, do you have any go-to techniques that you use to improvise?
Yeah, in terms of stylistically, always get the banker, the safe shot sort of in the can first, you know, as with the Richard Branson thing, you know, just get the safe shot done, and then at least you've got that. And that would be my soundest advice with anything. You have no idea what's going to change and how quickly it could change. And the atmosphere change is very volatile sometimes for people. And, you know, Alicia Keys, for example, I had to photograph her for Mojo, and, you know, she looks incredible. We love her oeuvre. She is, you know, like a proper 20 million albums, you know. So you come at it from a place of respect immediately. And so you get there early to the venue where she's recording, playing that night, where they want to do the shoot, and get there midday. We've got a slot of 1 o'clock, you know. And but she's not sound checking until 5 o'clock. And actually, she's not sound checking in makeup, so we can't shoot the sound check. So she's actually having her makeup back at the hotel done. She's on stage at 9:30. So we can go back to the hotel and get a couple of shots of her having her makeup done. It's like, okay, that's like 8 o'clock now. Haven't shot a frame. And then, you know, we go to the venue and we've then got 2.5 minutes to get sort of 7 or 8 pages or something of the Alicia Keys feature for Mojo. And, you know, and I went along with it, and as you do, because I really want to get the shots. And you are then complicit in an agreement that says, no matter what you've been asked to do, you can compress that into 2.5 minutes. And that is a challenge sometimes. So we luckily were in this venue where we could shoot, turn that way, get a shot, turn that way, get a shot. And the hoops you have to sort of jump through with a massive American, especially, star like that is many. And but, you know, got the shots, so smashed it.
Just out of curiosity, yeah, I was going to say, actually, those are really good shots.
Yeah, thanks. They are. It was hard, really hard.
You mentioned there, this is not on my plan of questions, but just really curious, that when you say you deal with an American star, what are some of the hurdles that people you have to jump through?
Well, in her case, we were with, you know, her delightful UK PR. So, you know, we agree the shots we'd like to try and achieve. And it's editorial, so in theory, the magazine has trusted me to get the shots. The artist wants the coverage, so they are allowing access. But it's a little bit more nuanced than that, maybe. And you then explain what you'd like those shots to be to an American publicist. You explain where you're going to do them to her security. You then go explain the whole thing again to her PA. And then eventually you get to meet her and she says, right then, what are we doing? And you explain it all again. And then she'll say whether she's up for it or not. So you have an absolutely first-rate lighting person with you. You have a camera that's tried and tested and you know it's going to work. And you think, okay, I will compress this whole thing into no time at all, you know. And again, it worked out really, really well. But it's nerve-wracking for sure.
A massive part of photography is light, and light is something which, from a novice perspective, it's so intimidating to, because it's got so much depth to it. I mean, in my own experiences, I'd shot a bunch of video, and then the first shoot we had a cinematographer on. It was like the standard of the quality of the video just went through the roof, and I was like, hail the cinematographer. What were some of the ways that you learned how to use light?
Similarly, it's a great question, because I was terrified of it when I first started, and eventually, excuse me, progressed to sort of flash on camera, you know, and then bouncing flash and then getting the flash off the camera, getting somebody in a crowd scene to say, behold, a remote flash. And then you sort of think, oh, OK, just with control and a bit of experience and a bit of bravery, you can start expanding on this. And then you get into sort of studio lighting, and then you're just pleased to get a result. And then you're pleased to learn, because I never assisted, which is a big thing, which is why they're sort of big gaps in my knowledge, or there were big gaps in my knowledge when I was coming up. So progress was a lot slower with me. If I'd done the hard 2 or 3 years of just assisting loads of different photographers, then you have to learn it, because you have to know. Because if you don't know the difference between Broncolor, Elinchrom, Profoto, you know, these loads of different brands all work differently, then what are they doing with you? You know, so I just found my own way very slowly. But it is I know this sounds like an oxymoron, but it is a dark art, the skill of crafting light. And there are very few people that are really, really good at it in stills, that can read a room, read a situation, work out what will not just get a result, but get a really well-crafted result, you know. So I work together with those people just to try and generate the feel that we want that's relevant to me and the shots that we want with the person we're with.
From all your experience on set and everything, if you had to start again, but you could take away three tidbits of information or little tips that you use day to day, what would you extract and take away with you to start again?
Definitely what I said to you about learning the technical, to get on top of all of that technical stuff, so that both with cameras, lighting and software, so that you can always craft the images you want to craft, and that's the investment in your own practice, I think, really. So yeah, get on top of the technical. In terms of mining contacts, I think the information is a lot more public now about how to reach people that you want. So always just remember everyone you've worked with and try and keep some sort of hold on them. And just contact is really, really vital, especially more so now. And just really, really always get what you want. Don't ever leave a shoot without getting what you hoped you were going to get, unless your hand's been forced, you know. But just really, really trying to push and push and push to get what you want without being a dick about it, because there's too many, man. And that's really, really important. So what have we got? Technical, don't be a dick, and number three, bring cake to podcast recordings, because it obviously softens up the team.
That's true. Everyone's cheerful now. There's some other big names in portrait photography, or at least people that I'm familiar with, people like Rankin and Platon, and they're the ones I know most readily. Obviously, you're up there as well in terms of the people that you've shot. Are there other? What do you think of their work, number one? And also, are there other people that you go, oh, do you know what, they should be in the mix with those guys?
You can't take away, the achievements of Rankin, and I think Platon will go down as a great. His look, you know, it's just absolutely beautiful. I really, really respect him. I think Annie Leibovitz is still working, man. Like, she really, really turned me on initially with some beautiful Rolling Stone magazine projects, work that she did, and just how good she's been for how long. I know she's quite a controversial figure in lots of ways, you know, but she's still smashing it, and with beautiful pictures that are so well crafted. And I hate it when I hear people sort of pulling her down, because she's been such a big figure for so long. Like, have you any idea how hard that is to maintain, you know, to keep not innovation as such, but just the quality of her output, the consistency of that. I really, really admire. And I know that's a bit of a lazy choice, but I don't think she gets the recognition she always deserves, you know. Bruce Weber and Herb Ritz, are guys that really got me into it initially, the power of their beautiful black and white portraits, mainly fashion. But, you know, I went to this fantastic evening by Giles Dooley the other day. Do you know him?
I'm not familiar, no.
So Giles Dooley, dear listener, please look up the work of Giles Dooley, his just incredible project work that I'm so admiring him. He's a triple amputee who was embedded with an American army squadron. I don't quite know what the right word is. He's trod on a landmine and lost three of his limbs and is out there photographing now. He's just done a fantastic project called Legacy of War, and he put it on down at, in Brick Lane in London, and created an evening of music and food and discussion and artworks. And I really happily paid for my ticket because I'm just a fan of anyone that driven. And his story is really, really good. He's done TED Talks and stuff like that about it. And just, I really, really admire his dedication to the craft. And, you know, it makes all of our efforts look very trifling, you know.
You talk about dedication, hard work. I listened to an interview with Rankin where he talked about how many of his close relatives and stuff like that have in the past have kind of gone by the wayside because he was so driven, because he was so in love with his work that he was pouring every part of him into it.
Yeah.
You strike me as someone that has a bit more of a work-life balance. Obviously, I don't know you very well, but it seems like your personal projects seem like a good way for you to escape the day job and to delve into some deeper, more meaningful subject matter, maybe. What's your take on work-life balance and that kind of thing?
It's interesting that my work-life balance is paid work and sort of personal work. So I don't have any other projects really, other sort of aspects to my life beyond my family and photography, which probably isn't that healthy. I do a bit of yoga. I was learning to dive, but I got injured, and dive off, you know, diving boards, which I really enjoyed that for a while. I was quite proud of myself. It's quite a hard undertaking. It was all about sort of taking more risks in my life, and I thought, what greater physical embodiment of taking risk could be than leaping off a diving board, you know? So I did that for a couple of years.
That sounds fantastic. What else did you do during that period of risk taking?
Well, it was just actually, this might sound weird, but it was say no to more things. So say no to more things that I was offered that I just didn't want to do that were just for money, and just actually prioritise stuff that I really singly give a shit about, you know. And I've had, without again wanting to sound like a dickhead, I've had checks for £10,000 and I've had checks for, or payments, you know, for £50. And like the magazine with the two naked guys that I, you know, when I got that check for £25 through, that meant more to me, the significance of that, than huge payments that I've had for me, huge payments. Some guys are like, they're very used to that, I'm sure, but because of what it meant, you know. And it's all about chasing back that feeling of opening them, chasing back to the feeling of that magazine, opening that magazine and seeing that shot. So now a huge amount of my decision-making process about my projects are about the end, working backwards from happiness, basically, that what will make me happy, where's my time best invested, and okay, in order to be happy, I want to feel fulfilled. What will make me fulfilled? A really, really interesting and engaged project about something stupid that I just can't shake from my mind, you know. And okay, how can I do that? And then, you know, right back to, right, let's go and shoot it.
In the final segment of the interview, I wanted to ask Tom about his range of experiences working with notable individuals. Often famous people have intensive schedules and are used to getting their own way. And I wanted to uncover what some of his best and worst experiences have been to date. Just following on from what we were just talking about with regards to your subject matter, you've predominantly shot famous individuals. And is that something that you always wanted to do?
Yeah, I think so. It's held as a sort of benchmark to your capability, I suppose, in some way, that you're allowed to get near these people. And I never dreamt that I'd be one day sharing the same space as Usain Bolt. You know, he's not a celebrity, is he? You know, he's an astonishing God-given talent, you know, that is remarkable. And, you know, his feet, I took a photo of his feet once and he was like, what'd you do that for? And I was like, because they're the fastest feet in the history of all feet ever. And in the history of feet, you know. And I'm sure you get it.
Yeah.
and Andy Warhol said that my idea of a good pick is one that's, in focus and of a famous person. And I completely subscribe to that. Like, it's great. People respond really positively to shots of very famous people, especially if they're famous people that they like. So a shoot I did with Gilbert and George went really, really well. You know, the results of it were really, really positive because people love Gilbert and George, you know.
We briefly spoke about Ed, a prior guest that we had on prior to talking today, and it was interesting that his point on it was how, you know, when he did a shoot for Adidas, that all of a sudden he got overwhelming amounts of credit for having it being attached to a big brand. Mm. And I wondered, to some degree, you know, when you shoot your personal projects versus shooting Tiny Temper or Usain Bolt or Richard Branson, you know, they have so much more gravitas because people recognise them, I guess.
It certainly helps. It certainly helps for me to put, you know, some of the quite random personal work that I do nestled on my feed and my website next to famous people, just because it just gives them weight, I think, you know, which is a shame, but it works.
There's an aspect to photography which plays into the subject of ego, and when I was going through your work, there was one person that just drew my attention, and I'm not familiar with the person, but it was Roy Ink.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, some of his videos have his name flashing about, and he's dramatised quite considerably. Just wondering what his story was and also what your take is with regards to photography and ego and that kind of thing.
So Roy Ink is absolutely fascinating, and I met him about 5 years ago and happily, luckily, kept in contact with him because he's a beautiful example of a person, and it is Roy Ink in big capitals, but he's by no means a egomaniac or anything like that. He's just an artist and is part of the sort of tranny drag scene, I suppose, but is an astonishingly creative individual that was a pure joy to shoot. So, and he just gets cameras, gets lenses. He knows what he's got to do to deliver a great picture. And, you know, you do meet some astonishing egos in this business, but you're not there to necessarily challenge that. I don't think you're there to sort of ride it, really, and just get the thing that you want, your publication wants, or whoever it might be, you know? So yeah, it can be quite interesting. Egos on the way up tend to be pretty awful, and when the star is waning can be quite awful as well. But anyone riding high who's comfortable in their position and just comfortable with their success is really interesting. The biggest, most fascinating character I've ever been in the presence of, I think, in many ways, was Josh Homme from Queens of the Stone Age, right? So I just thought he could have been an amazing politician. His control over a crowd and his ability, his comfort with being incredibly famous. He's eloquent, really good looking, alpha male all the way. And I was just had to keep shooting with him because he wasn't going to take any direction from me, that's for sure. But that's totally fine if you deliver. And he was, you know. So he really, really interesting study on that guy. You know, really fascinating for me.
So you talk there about, that's, I guess, a pretty positive experience, but just for the flip side and for our amusement, who's been the worst person to work with?
Can't tell you.
Come on, spill the beans. No, this is the time to do
it. No, it's not. No form of professional would ever answer that,
no,
I don't
okay.
think.
All right.
I haven't quit. Can we talk when I've retired?
Sure,
When the really big ones rolled in,
well,
I will very happily.
For the listeners, I did try. there's a guy who has been a massive inspiration for me, an art director called George Lois, an American guy. And back in the day, he did the Esquire covers that ended up in the Academy of Arts in America. And one thing that was always really stunning about his work is that he tried to, for them to be some form of social commentary, and oftentimes they featured famous individuals. Is that something that you've ever tried to do, to intertwine, not necessarily a concept, but do you feel like, do you consider culturally what's going on when you take your shots?
That's a great question. I think I'm not going to try and avoid it, but I think I provide in my work a balanced view of my experience. So if that's the Herder Boys of Lesotho, or if it's 24 hours, the longest day, we photograph every, well, not every, I shouldn't think, but, you know, colour, creed, sexuality, you know, in the longest day. And that's maybe how I try and provide balance and commentary in what I do as best as I can. I can't force it into what I do. I'm trying to think of some other examples where I have done a bit of that, but, you know, if it's, and probably in that is why I tend to, you know, I do commercial work and jobs and advertising stuff and things like that where you've got zero control over injecting that sort of thing. I do editorial work where maybe you've got a bit more control if you're lucky, if you've got time and people are willing to jump in with your concept, which generally they're not, because they've got PR people to stand well and truly in the way of anything blazingly creative.
the burden of our industry?
I think so. Feels like it sometimes. I've had some shocking experiences with that, and only for it never to have been even communicated to the artist. You know, they are the firewall that against which your ideas scorch and burn, you know. So there's just really left with your personal work and your personal projects to. So I've got a really lovely new portrait project that I'm shooting in East London, in my local pub, the Palm Tree in Bow, right? Which for 40 years has had jazz sort of crooners every Friday, Saturday and Sunday nights. And it's a well-known sort of institution of that on the sort of what was a really busy, buzzing circuit of that sort of as an entertainment in a pub. And it's just not anymore. It's really, really dying out, you know. So this pub has merrily sort of stuck with it, and God love them for that, because it is absolutely brilliant. And I know them really well, and they've allowed me access to shoot the last of the crooners. And that is my comment on maybe on gentrification of the area, which I'm guilty of. I live there. I'm not from there. But it's changing and evolving, and the Olympics has had a massive impact on East London and the people it's sort of drawn into the area. It's a great place to be, and it's diverse, and that is very much celebrated. And but I think my commentary is made in via routes like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense.
Was it boring?
No, not at all. I think it's just a more subtle way of doing it. I mean, he always describes himself as a cultural provocateur.
Yeah.
And that is
Muhammad Ali with the arrows in his side. Yeah. Was that him?
Yes, and the depiction of the boxer flat out in the ring before the fight. So he was making calls on who might win, or Nixon with his makeup on. And, you know, just...
Yeah.
There was a fascinating one of a Vietnam chap who'd killed lots of people in the war, and then he made him pose with a shot of like 10 Vietnamese children.
Wow.
And, you know, gave him some spiel about how it was about something else, and it was just purely to draw attention to the fact that he'd wiped out all the families of you know, children, Vietnamese children and that kind of thing.
For somebody to be able to get all of that story into one cover image, and for it to be a lead image in that way that people... the whole story is easily read from that. I really, really admire that, because it's so hard to do now.
And to your point about having to fight up against PR folks and everything, I mean, to some degree, you have to be a bull to really force your ideas through. And I think that's what he's a massive champion of, and the face of, you know, be strong, be willing to sell your ideas, you know, that kind of thing. If you could shoot anyone, who's on your hit list? Like, who would you love to photograph?
Yeah, I really, really wanted to photograph Harry Dean Stanton.
Right.
And he died last month, I think it was. And I was really sad about that, because I really admired his beautiful old face and his work that he'd done. And that really kicked me in the nuts, actually, just that I hadn't made any efforts to sort of, you know, with things like that, you just hope that they'll come around, you know, to you somehow. And I've got to stop doing that. I've got to be more proactive and just actually write my list. And I'd really like to photograph Matthew McConaughey. Don't know why. I just think he's got a great face.
Yeah.
I photographed Richard Ashcroft for Q magazine this year, which was something I'd always wanted to do just purely on the basis of having such a great face. So I am quite lucky with some things like that. But, you know, I'd
like you say, you need a bucket list.
Yeah, I do. I did photograph Smokey Robinson, which was a proper career goal, whose music, had, you know, I'd known since I'd known what music was. And that was really, really nerve-wracking. And just because I wouldn't have cocked it up, but there's always the feeling that I could have done. And when you take a beautiful portrait of an icon like that, for me, that's about as good as life gets. And it was, we did the shoot in 15 minutes, and then I went to Lord's to watch cricket.
That was a
really, really amazing day, yeah.
Very few people get to meet as many well-known people as you have. Just, you know, across a very, very broad range of people like that, have there been any characteristics that you've identified that could feasibly be responsible for their successes?
I think it's probably too broad a spectrum of people that I've met. You know, Richard Branson's a really interesting cat for that he isn't actually, for somebody who is photographed so much, he's quite hard to shoot, actually, and he's really, really up for the opportunity, but is quite hard to sort of get a really lovely shot of, actually. And I photographed him quite a lot, and you know, that the single portrait I've got of him on my website is the only frame that I would ever sort of share as being a wonderful moment, you know, or a really nice capture. So in terms of the uniqueness of their being, no, because some famous people were incredibly shy, and others are stone cold extroverts that love every second of it, or certainly get into character for a camera. So the ideal thing that gets easier and easier is for them to trust you, and the more evidence they can see that you've handled people more famous than them makes the opportunity work that much better. So right, when I, as part of my disarming technique, I don't know if this answers your question, let's find out. I'm in David Gilmour's house in Sussex, and we're told very strictly we have 20 minutes with David Gilmour, and we're setting up, and we know we've got a bit of time because they've gone off to do the interview. And David Gilmour walks in and goes, they're actually interviewing my wife at the moment, so I thought we'd do the photos now, shall we? And I was like, does my 20 minutes start now? Because we're not ready. And he sat down, and it was really, really... It was a lovely experience, actually. Super cool guy, very understated. And I was trying to buy a bit more time because I knew the lighting guy wasn't ready. And I looked through the camera and then sort of lower it again and say, do you know what I'm really aware of when I photograph people like you is how many dickheads like me you've met. And it's a real nod to his ego, his awkwardness, and the complete lack of sort of requirement for him to have to do any more photo shoots ever again, you know. And he actually laughed, and it sort of suggests a sort of calmness from me that I'm not uptight about this opportunity, and therefore it sort of generates trust, because you really need that trust. And that is a characteristic you hope for in somebody you're photographing, that they trust you to deliver as much as I trust them, you know. So that is a target characteristic. But when I rewind and listen to this later, I bet it suggests that I didn't answer your question properly.
No, that does. It does. You briefly touched on a minute ago with regards to Richard Branson and the fact that you had the one shot of him that you really, you know, elevate that. I noticed that on your website that you tend to just focus on one photograph, and, you know, a lot of photographers will have a project and they'll show three or four shots from that shoot. I'm guessing that's a conscious choice. And so maybe if you could explore that a little bit.
Well, it's actually a conscious choice in terms of website design in 2017. And you look at your stats and look how long people spend on your website. And actually, the Tumblr-style feed that I've got it on, just a Squarespace website, is about somebody clicking straight onto tomoldham.com and seeing exactly what kind of photographer I am in sort of less than 10 seconds. So I would love to get deeply involved in stories and putting more of that kind of content up there. But as the stats prove, nobody gives a shit. And that they're also doing the same thing on your Instagram, you know, that they go, bah, 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 yeah, he's fine, you know. And it's got to be instant impact. And which is a real shame because I used to get much more invested in that as a style. And then I thought, hold on, no one cares. Why am I overcomplicating website design with trying to sort of like, if you click through here, you can invest in this story here. But it's like, no one cares. And yeah.
I think that's a real good point. And yeah, I think lots of people can take away from that. Final question before I get into some quick fire questions.
It's
not a challenging one really, or I hope not. So for young people, because a lot of people that listen to this show, they tend to be graduates, people that are really interested in photography. Ollie in the other room is one of those individuals that, you know, I'm sure he could learn from your years of expertise. What are some of the things that people trip up on and things that, you know, if you said, you know what, focus on this and it will just 10x your output?
So in a, you know, feat of sort of stupidity, really, even though I, like I told you, I worked at the art college after I'd done my 2-year course. I didn't invest nearly enough time in the studios and that using all the equipment and facilities I had available. So to anyone at college or, you know, doing their own version of a degree, maybe not a university, but just the university of life and all that, just hammering the technical, just getting on top of the craft, the skills that, you know, the first 10 years are for free, you know. So anyone thinking that they're not, who hasn't done their 10,000 hours is possibly got a shock coming, you know. But I also know loads and loads of people starting out that wanted to be photographers more than they liked photographing. And there's a really clear distinction with that, that they bought cameras that had big grips and big looking lenses and stuff because that's what they thought they ought to have. But actually going out and photographing is more important than that. And I love that now those people hopefully rise to the top that just really, really enjoy it. And, you know, like fashion photographers had a sort of reputation from the 60s onwards, probably, of just like being cads that liked being around women and, you know, were always white males that, but do they last? I don't know if they do. I don't think they do because it's hard work. To get paid and deliver is really hard work and people don't stick with it. And really, it's cutthroat, man. And I don't actually feel that bad about people that aren't very good, who don't make it, you know, because it's hard. And if you haven't got this sort of makeup for it, then it's good that you're not going to put yourself through it, because I really, really love what I do. But man, it has made me cry. I've had astonishing highs and crushing lows with this. And you know, you could have a 9-to-5 job, you know, where you won't experience any emotions at all, maybe, or some things will irritate you a bit and there'll be some good laughs as well. But, and not to look down on that in any way at all, if that's your choice, then that's fine. But in this job, if you haven't got the steel for it, don't waste your time because it will crush you.
I think going right back to one of our early questions about there being a lot of photographers about, I think the thing that happens is the cream rise to the top, right? And the people that are up at 5 in the morning and bed at 10 at night and obsessed with what they do.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's a really nice way to move on into the quick fire round.
Have you got a little jingle for the quick fire round?
Exactly like that. That's how it works. Yeah.
Well, feel free to use that.
That's it. We'll rip that sound design. Copyrighted. Favourite film or documentary?
Ooh. I really love Motorcycle Diaries. There's an incredible comedy that Robert De Niro did called Midnight Run. Do you know that?
I don't know, but I love Robert De Niro.
No one ever knows it, right? And it's like I'm really knackered. I've got to go to bed, and it's on ITV3+1, and it's midnight, and I'm like, oh no, Midnight Run's on. Got to watch it, and that will be my, like, go to bed at 2 a.m. and my wife will be like, what's wrong with you? And it's like, a Midnight Run was on telly. She'll go, oh, dickhead.
I absolutely love Robert De Niro. And then when he started doing comedies, I was like, man. But then, like, if you say this is the one, then make...
So the one.
Okay.
And you'll thank me.
All right, I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Book or learning resource?
Book or learning resource. I read a real lot of rock and roll biographies. but that isn't a great learning resource, that's for sure. I've got a fantastic guide. It's got a red cover about tips from tutors about photography, that where they have one page tips about projects, how to shoot projects, and absolutely bugger me. I've totally forgotten what it's called.
We'll stick it in the show notes.
Would you mind?
No problem.
I'll let you know. Yep. Because it's a bit annoying to say it without that, but you can hopefully see it if you're watching this, listening to this online. You'll be able to see it now. And it's an absolutely fantastic goldmine of get you out and get you shooting. And not that I've actually acted on any of it, but it's really invigorating about your processes and why and what. And go and photograph the impossible. There wasn't a quick fire answer, was it? Sorry.
A newsletter people should subscribe to.
Mine.
Okay, there you go, sorted.
And ideas books.
Yeah.
Idea books. Do you know them, Idea Online?
Idea Online.
Bookshop.
No.
Man, if you want to know what is happening in super cool, edgy book and magazine publishing, Idea Online is just the most beautiful resource of just like, and they've sent, do this really hilarious mail out. And obviously things like Creative Review, and it's nice that, but I really like Idea. It's a different tangent. So,
oh, amazing. I'll check that out.
Please do. It's really good.
Apart from your Hasselblad, what other photography resources couldn't you live without, or tools that you use on set?
There's a really, really essential thing that I use absolutely consistently is a Broncolor Move Pack, which is a 1200 watt battery powered two head lighting kit, which means you can shoot on location with proper studio quality power, but anywhere, because it's battery. So that with a Fotex Softlighter diffuser is my absolute go-to. When I've only got 3 seconds with Richard Branson, it's like, that will be the one that will nail it.
Nerd alert.
Sorry, man, you asked.
No,
I'm
joking.
What do you think?
That's perfect. The 37269. No, that's exactly what I wanted. So, yeah, thanks for that. Final question on the quickfires. What's a great present for you?
Oh, man. Holiday. Yeah. Why? You got a little envelope.
I wish I had the money to take you on holiday. Mm. But, yeah, if anyone's listening and wants a photo shoot in, what country are you requesting?
I haven't done much in South America, so that'd be good.
Okay, there you go.
Peru.
Perfect. So before I ask you the final question and reveal how people can get hold of you, I'm going to pass the show over to our producer, Adam, who's going to share some actual insights from our interview today.
Well, thanks for joining us, Tom, and thank you for sharing your wealth of experience with us. Here's the 5 actionable insights that I captured as you were talking. Number 1, prioritise your best idea first. You won't always have time to get all the shots that you want. Number 2, to be a great portrait photographer, you need a clear vision. Give your subject clear direction and be so experienced with your equipment that you're only engaging with your subject. Number 3, if you can create a harmonious environment in your studio and in the way that you do things, it will create positive experiences. Number 4, if you've got a subject you really want to picture, then do something about it. You don't know what might happen tomorrow. And number 5, if you want to see the definition of drive, then be sure to look up war photographer Giles Dooley.
Thank you, Adam. Some really great insights there. So to sum up, before I ask you the final question, where can people get hold of you, and do you have any asks for the audience?
I really value people contacting me that I usually get from a lot of different friends. So a lot of my ideas have been people that come to me and say, have you thought about this? And I just really like to hear from people. I really like engagement, and www.tomoldham.com and at TommyOphoto. I'm the most easily Googleable person, so, you know, there isn't too many Tom Oldhams. I did meet another Tom Oldham the other day, which is quite weird. So asks from the audience, more love, please. Just more love.
So final question, it's a slightly deeper one. If you had the opportunity to give the world one piece of advice to live a better and more meaningful life, what would it be?
Great question. Professionally, my advice would be the Helsinki bus station theory. Do you know about that?
I have no idea about that. So, yeah, please expand.
Apparently, the Helsinki bus station is so unfathomably complicated that the worst thing you can do is get off the bus. So you are hopefully on the right bus to where you're going, but if you're not, the worst thing you can do is get off the bus. So stay on the fucking bus.
We'll leave it there. I think that's a great way to end. Tom, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe and share. I'd also like to invite you to an ongoing project called the Move Me Mailing List. If you enjoyed the show, I'm confident you'll enjoy this newsletter. It contains links to all the great content I've uncovered each month, along with insights of any interesting opportunities I've discovered. You can subscribe to this by visiting my website at rickyrichards.com. A special thanks to Frankie Byrne and James Utting. They're the tech heads that make this show possible. The intro music was composed by Dom Stores Fox, and thanks again to Reese Chapman for introing me to Lou and Lizette, the wonderful folks at Factory Studios in London, where this show is recorded. Finally, wherever you are in the world, I hope you have a great day and keep creating. Until next time, bye for now.